And we are back. We are back. I think this one we'll call Let Them Cook. Let Them Cook. You know, like Let Them Cook. Ach! Oh, Tam's been waiting with that one. We didn't even know. For those that are listening, you may have heard a laugh that you're not used to hearing. For those that are watching, you can see a man in the corner of your screen. I don't know how to point which side you'll be, but he's there. We have another special, very, very, very special guest with us today. And as I usually do, I like to introduce our guests with a little bit of a backstory. So where to start with this guy? Yes. So we've been friends for a real long time. We met in grade one. We became quite close, I would say, a little bit later, maybe grade three or four-ish is where we started really becoming friends. And then grade six and seven, we were real tight, went to different high schools, so got a little bit separated, but then found each other once again around grade 10, 11, I would say. And post-school, we got real, real close, me and the man himself on screen. But before I tell you his name, I just want to say we walked a long path together. We did a lot of stuff together, good and bad. We know each other, born on the same day as well, which is quite a special thing. And this guy is a very, very unique and very, very special person. And the reason that I say that is because he didn't have the easiest time in high school. There were a lot of difficulties growing up. And to be honest with you, watching him and seeing his growth and everything that I've experienced with him as long as I've known him, he's one of the most resilient people I've ever met. One of the most resourceful people I've ever met. One of the most hardworking people I've ever met. And we were just talking off air how he's really, really shifted and become a trustworthy human being, a trustworthy man, a reliable person. And that is our one and only, let's call him what, Noble Nato? Notable Nato? What are we going with?
I love that. It's okay. Just call me Chef Nato. I'm all good, guys. Thank. That was such a great introduction. And thanks. You know, you actually, it's a lot deeper than I expected it to be. You kind of got me in my feels at the start of this. So
hey,
thank you.
Let's go.
Let's go. But yeah, like Ty said, I've known Ty for more years in my life than I haven't at this stage. You know, I've known his family. From his mom to his dad to everybody, he knows mine, our story, our struggle. We spend holidays together and stuff. So he's a true gent, he's a true brother, and I'm still 45 minutes older than you. Never forget
that. Had to drop it in.
Had to. I always do. And Tevin, thank you for having me here on this platform. I love what you guys do, and I'm just happy to be here. You know?
Nah, it's really our pleasure, man. Like Tyler said, you are a man of many talents, many accolades. And just to give a bit more backstory and background to the man that you are and the occupation that you do, can you just tell everyone what you do?
Okay, so I'm currently the head chef of Ren Urban Nest, or Alt Cafe, so in Dublin, Ireland.
Nice.
It's Europe's first zero net carbon hotel. So it's kind of a big deal, you know, it's kind of cool. We only opened about 2 years ago, but that's kind of what I am. I'm a friend, I'm a brother, I'm a son, and I'm a chef. That's how I kind of look at it. I'm a chef last, I'm all of those first though. Mm. You
know? And the idea to, settle in Ireland for your occupation, for your life, for what you thought would be the better future. Can you give some context to that? When did you have the idea to move over? Did you think an island? Why Ireland, essentially?
Okay, to answer that question, I kind of have to take it back a little bit.
Let's do
it. That's okay. All right. So, you know, there was a time where I was a what you would call a stay-at-home son. So I'm going to speak to all the stay-at-home sons there, if you kind of know what that does. I wasn't really contributing too much, but what I always loved was watching MasterChef at 7 o'clock on Mnet for our South African viewers, right? And I would watch that every day as a stay-at-home son, and my dad would come in like, "Yeah, you're really good at this thing. You're really good. Why don't you just try go to the school?" And you know, there's this concept or this stigma around being a chef in South Africa that it's kind of the easy way out. Like, you're just being a chef. It's not a real profession. So that's the kind of mindset that I had. I was nervous to undertake that, but through convincing my dad to go to the school, and what happened was when I went to the school, I realized I was actually really good, and I actually really loved what I did, and I excelled. For the first time in school setting, I excelled. So I did that for about a year, and then I got an opportunity to go to the United States. All right, so I managed to go to the United States, to Florida, and I was recruited by one of 65 in the world, a certified master chef, Mr. Daniel Scannell. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So, yes, we were four South Africans chosen out of a couple of hundred people on the short list, and we ended up going over there. And kind of that's where I want to say my actual journey in terms of real chefing, in terms of understanding what it means, not just in South Africa, but globally, that there's one language, the chefing language, and no matter where you go, there's still that one language, which is the kitchen.
Yeah.
So it started there. And I was out in the States for, you could say, approximately about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, I met somebody, and she was an Irish person, and she kind of convinced me to go to Ireland. And, you know, yeah, it's a great opportunity as a chef to go to Europe. And I was like, you know what, that is good. Let me go to Europe, and that's what I'm going to pursue. And that's what we did, I guess, you know. I packed up everything that I knew. I left America, and I went to Dublin. And then about a month later, COVID hit, so we kind of know how that goes.
But, So you landed in Ireland with your whatever that you were allowed to take on the plane, and obviously your partner. And COVID hit. So what happened in that time after COVID? How did you make ends meet? And what happened? How did you end up at this as a head chef of this unique, I guess, what did you say, zero carbon emission hotel?
Yeah, so obviously the experiences that I had in America led me in good stead, because I used to work in 5-star country clubs.
Okay.
So these are prestigious country clubs around the world, and I worked for a great chef. So when I got to Dublin, it was tough initially, because now all the visa offices had closed and everything had kind of shut down. And now you're coming into this country bright-eyed, you're trying to make your way. It's just not happening. You know, hospitality is dead, you know, and it kind of depressed you, because one thing my dad always said to me, you know, being a chef, one thing is people will always need to eat. Regardless of recession, regardless of whatever, you got a trade, people are always going to need to eat. You'll always have a job. Yeah. So, and this is the one time in our life when you looked at it and you're like, wow, how important actually am I, you know, to everything. But, you know, I was, like you said in the intro, I'm relatively very resourceful, and I'm a talker, hustler. I guess. I'm a hustler, you know? And when I got to the country, I went to some recruiters, and I met a guy who had worked for me, and he was running it as a takeaway. So I was very lucky enough to still have a job. It was never at the level that I'm working at now, but because of COVID and I'm in a new country, you take whatever.
Take what you get.
Take what you get, you know, you take what you get. So I ended up working. I was just doing a takeaway here and there for the duration of COVID, which I want to say in Ireland was about a year and a half to 2 years running on, which was hard, but that's what we did. And then as soon as COVID ended, everything opened up. I then knew I could use the talents that I had and the experience that I had. And then I ended up working for a Michelin star chef out in Malahide, Oliver Dunn. And I was his sous chef for a while there. And time went on, and I just knew that I wanted to do more, because, you know, he's a Michelin star chef and I'm not. I work under him, and I wanted to be him, but I was never going to be him in his
kitchen. I was
never going to be him in his kitchen. So I had to kind of do my research and kind of look around, and through people in contact that I met, they told me they were opening up this hotel, and it's called The Wren. And I didn't know too much about it at the time, and they're like, look, it's a little bit of a unique idea. They want to run a zero waste kitchen. They want to do the whole sustainability thing. And for me, that was incredible and great, because I was just thirsty for a new adventure.
Yeah.
And that just said to me, try and go. And I went, and the GM or the owners of the place were, me and them just kind of got along from day one. We had the same visions. We had the same ideas. You know, everything we spoke about was just in line, and we kind of got the gig. I got the gig, and I've kind of run with it since then. And, you know, I think that was the best decision I made in my life ever. Just to say that. Yeah.
Oh, that's so quite cool, man. That's really... No, no, that's actually like really, really interesting. I wanted to ask you, so now you are the head chef of this kitchen, right?
Yes.
Oh, I like it. Oh, we need to put that in, Tev. We need to put that in the title. Yeah? And how did it work? Before we get into like all the flexing of you, I just want to ask a question. Did you design the menu at the Ren, or is it something you did with the owners together, or how does it work in that case, like as the head chef?
Yeah, so you do design the menu. All right, so you come in there and they want to know what you're going to bring. So, like, this is the ideas that I had, and I had a little bit of experience from different countries and whatever. So that's what we do. We design the menu with – the whole idea is the Wren, if you guys don't know, is a bird. It's a little Irish bird. Okay. So I created this mission vision that, like, okay, this Wren bird is kind of me. It's traveled the world, and it's kind of picking up a little pieces from everywhere, and it's coming back to the nest, which is Wren Urban's nest, with all these pieces, and it's building the nest. With all these influences. So I try to kind of bring that through. I'm not necessarily just fully Irish or American or my French technique, but I try to bring my African heritage from my mom and my gran, a little bit of Asian techniques that I've learned. So it's kind of a melting pot because we're still a hotel. Everybody from around the world comes. So So being a head chef, that's what we do. I created the menu with help with the directors and owners. And yeah, I guess
Did you audition? Did you have to cook for them, or was it just a conversation? Because how do they know you can cook? You can't tell me on paper that you can cook.
No, it kind of did feel like a little bit of an audition, but that's why I say, like, I walked in and the GM at the time, the hotel hadn't even opened, so you go into this building and it's closed off from outside. So you go down and it's like there's two people working in there. And like my GM there, she's an Australian lady, very cool, 40-old-ish lady, right? So we go in there and she's like, okay, what can you offer? And she gave me homework. She just said to me, come back and tell me what you're going to do for this place. And for her, I think that's how she knew if I came back. And she didn't tell me when to come back. She just said to me, come back and show me what you want to do for this place. And I went home and I was just so inspired by everything. And I literally made a whole dossier of ideas, things that I want to do. Yeah. And I came back within 2 days. And when I came back, she was even so surprised. Like, wow, you came back. Nobody comes back. And I was like, yeah, but this is what I want to bring to the space. And then from that day, she was like, you know, me and you are the same. You get what I'm doing. It's about the hard work. It's about trying new things. No one has the answers because no one has done this yet. But you're willing to try and we'll figure this out together. And then that's kind of how it went. And then I guess my CV kind of says I can cook. I mean, I wouldn't been able to travel as much as I did.
So she didn't taste your food. This is my question. She didn't actually chow your food. This is my question.
No.
She's just like...
No, she loved I guess. She loved the pants. The pants, you know? The pants. The pants was
That's
enough.
Crazy. That's crazy initially. To me. I don't know.
Yeah. Even in the hospitality world, you go on a trust policy, man. And I think what the fascinating thing and the really great part of your story is that you came in at a time when it was groundbreaking, at a time when there was, I mean, like level pegging, and it took a lot of shared investment, shared vision, and a big buy-in from everyone's part to grow it to the place that it is now. And I've been fortunate to come and see the Wren, and yeah, man, if you were to imagine like opulence and something like top billing, it's like that. And now if you have that as the basis and then you take on the food, incredible food from the breakfast to the lunch and the suppers, the layout, the design, and most importantly, the people. I don't think I've had the luxury of meeting such friendly, homely people. I know a lot of people throw that idea out there and the term that, it feels like home. But honestly, people from the moment that you walk through the doors at the Wren, the people at the reception counter, people that are in the alt bar, there's just so much buy-in from people to treat you like, firstly, a person, which in Europe is a very something that's quite rare, and two, just to make it feel welcoming. So I think from the experience that I've had, I can't speak highly of the Wren, and maybe that's why it's received so many awards, so many accolades, so much praise. And the one that I had come across was the the SEAI Energy Award in 2022. This is where the Ren Oben Nest and BDP take home the award for energy in buildings at last year's SEAI Energy Awards. Do you want to give us a bit more context?
Yeah, I can give you a little bit into it. I'm not the architects and I didn't build the building, so I have a limited knowledge about all the ins and outs of it, you know, but I do know the moment that happened. So BDP are basically the architects who kind of designed the building. And then we had Alpha and Duggins, who were there. It goes a lot into who built the building. But with BDP, it was incredible. You know, they show us from the concrete that was used is Irish concrete. Everything is local. And it's got this breathability that it absorbs the heat and stores the heat. You know, certain things like that. Like when you're in the lobby downstairs, what we like to call the hive, you know, all the heat that's generated from people talking and up and down, that then gets absorbed and helps to warm up your showers, you know, up the showers that you have in the morning. Yeah, so there's a lot from the way the building's designed, how it's facing, how the windows are designed to hold the heat in and to reflect it during summer and winter, the differences between that. I mean, the thought process, like I said, I'm not the architect. I can't tell you what stone they used, what brick they used, but I do know. Otherwise, I'd be in that job, you know. But I do know that there was a lot of work that went in, even before we came into the picture, that there was this idea of what was supposed to be this place. And they created the best vessel that we can, and they hired us as the best people to carry out that vision. So yeah, we're very proud of the initial investments and idea making of the people to get us to the point we are, because now we can just thrive off this building that they've created.
Exactly. Yeah. And yourself personally, I know you've also gotten quite a few accolades, awards. You've been in magazines, you've done some TV interviews. You want to just flex on us, man? Tell us about that. Yeah. Don't flex on us, man.
Don't hold back.
It kind of took me by surprise myself too. I won't lie, you know, when you first started here, but it just happened, you know. So I think the first one I received was recognition was there's this app called Too Good to Go here in Europe, and I think in some places in the States, and it's basically an app that is kind of designed to reduce food waste from restaurants and hotel facilities. So there's an app you can go on, and after my breakfast buffet, I have a surplus of food that will then generally go into my waste. Yeah. I then create 10 magic mystery boxes and make them online, and then people can purchase them for up to €4. And they can come, they don't know what they're getting, but instead of me throwing food away in the bin, whatever, they come, they purchase it, and we can help people out with that.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a way to minimize your waste. And you can set that for breakfast, for lunch. You can create how many meals you have available for that specific day, you know, and we were fortunate enough in Ireland that they wanted to launch their app at our restaurant and our hotel because it tied in. So they came in, RTE News, which is kind of it's a big news agency over here. They came in, they were interviewing us, kind of understanding why we've chosen to partner with them, why we chose to do this there. So that was really cool. And that goes in with the sustainability, you know, too.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the start. And then after that, you get a little bit more recognition. More people now are interested. They want to come. They want to see what we do. And then we received, in our first year, we received a McKenna's Award, which is kind of like, it is a prestigious kind of award for contemporary Irish food.
Okay.
So we got what, best in 2022 and 2021. So we received that award, and then we subsequently received another award from the same people for 2022 and 2023. So that was great too, you know, and I couldn't have done it without my team. I want to say that too. Like, I don't do this alone. Like, I have the vision, but everybody executes it.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
We have the vision, they execute it. And then now is kind of the creme de la creme of the awards. Yeah, it's the awards. So on Monday the 15th, we've been nominated in the Irish Restaurant Awards 2023, which is the prestigious award show for all of Ireland. This is all Ireland from all the counties. And we were nominated for Best Sustainable Practices. So, you know, fingers crossed, you know, sometimes, you know, we're in the middle of city center, and to even be nominated for this type of award in city center where things can get a little bit tough,
it's
just an honor in itself, you know. So hopefully we can come out with that award, but even not, we're going to be there and we'll be representing the Ren Hotel. So yes, let's go.
No, that's amazing, man. So you say you're going to this award on Monday now, coming up?
Yes, on Monday. Yeah, this is all Monday, right. Coming up. It's black tie. It's going to be cool.
Hey, wishing you all the best. Okay. So now, well, we have some questions. We have some follow-up questions.
Here we go.
To ask. So before we get into one of the... I wanted to ask you, as the head chef, you just threw a shout-out to your team. As a head chef, so I don't have the I haven't been to too many what we would call fine dining establishments, and I'm not so sure if the Ren is necessarily a fine dining establishment at those like hectic Michelin star levels. But I imagine it is quite a nice place. I had a look at the menu and at the restaurants, and it looks really, really cool. But my question is this: the one I went to was in South Africa called Marble with David Higgs, right? He's the chef there, and I was lucky enough. Katya spoiled me to a chef's table where we sat and watched the kitchen happen. And David Higgs, all he did that night was slice steak. I think that's all I saw him do. Now, is that just because he's David Higgs, or as a head chef, do you make the menu and then your guys carry it out, and you just kind of even when you watch Hell's Kitchen, right? Gordon Ramsay kind of just plates a few things and he checks it and he shouts at people and then he passes it out. Is that a true reflection on what it's like being the head chef, or are you more hands in the pot as one would say?
You know, it really depends on in the kitchens that you work, but the sign for David Higgs and Gordon Ramsay, it just shows what good chefs they are, because you know. You're leading, you know, the way I like to look at it, chefs are pirates. We're not normal people. We're dealing with knives. We're dealing with fire. Bad working hours, bad social hours. Like, the people who come into those kitchens are not generally normal people, you know?
Okay.
And to be a leader of a team of 10 guys, 10 men with this idea who want your job at the same time, who want to be you, but to still inspire them to the point where all you need to do to execute your vision is plate a few dishes, just shows how good and influential you are. Because not all the times do people have the privy to see exactly how you get them to that motivated state. You know, there's many times where they do question you, but when there's an issue happening, you need to be able to get in there, solve it within 2 seconds, and have them look at you and be like, okay, yeah.
You the guy. That's why you the guy.
He's the head chef for a reason.
If you don't do that, it's going to be mutiny. They're going to throw me overboard and someone else is going to take over. I mean, it's really like that, you know. You're dealing with guys who want your job and will do anything for your job, but still have to have this hunger for perfection, but to realize your dream as a chef. They almost have to sacrifice their dream to realize your dream. Like, I can have, there's many ways to skin a cat, but I want my plate plated this way.
Yes.
You may think, as my second in command, it should be done this way. No, but you have to sacrifice that ambition.
Mm. Yeah.
In order to follow what I
reality,
want.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, okay. So.
But I'm sure you still listen to what your second in command says. Like, if he's like, yo, but he's like, okay, maybe we should plate it like this. I'm sure you're not like, no, you're wrong. I am the head chef. It is like this. Or how much of a back and forth is it?
No, there are moments. I mean, there are moments where you yourself can lose creativity, and you almost need your second in command to push you. Otherwise, you just have people who are following orders. And then your creativity dies, and then your ambition dies, because you come into work and nobody's challenging you. You almost want to go into work and be like, he gives you this idea and you want to accept it, but then you want to take it back and take a little bit of it and better it. So it's not to say that I will discard what he said, but I take a little and be like, all right, I get that. Maybe if we can do it like this, like this, like this.
So there
has to be a little bit of respect and give and take, because if you don't give them a carrot, there's nothing to chase.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, yeah.
And for us that don't understand or don't know the depth of people in the kitchen. So what makes up a full kitchen? If you were to do a walkthrough of the different positions in the kitchen, so the people that are delivering the breakfast, the lunch, the supper, How many people comprise of your team? What are the different roles? What does that look like? So you as head chef, and then if you filter out the rest.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about then my team. Okay, my team is not the biggest team. I've worked in many bigger kitchens, but I still fulfill the necessary roles that all kitchens do. So for me, I think the most important person in my kitchen is my kitchen porter. And a lot of people will think differently. So the kitchen porter, our KP, is the person who cleans the kitchen, cleans my forks, cleans my pots, cleans my everything, my plates. If I don't have pots and pans, if I don't have stuff for my guests, I don't have a running kitchen. I need my kitchen to be clean and moving so my chefs can focus on chefing. Most important person, access my deliveries. I then have what you then call your commis chefs, which is your entry-level chefs that you have to kind of give guidance. But they're the most kind of the most hungry and the most potential because you can guide them in any which way. Yeah. They're really important. So they're always there with assistance with a senior chef. So we'd have our breakfast chefs in the morning. We'd have two chefs and a KP on and one commis chef to help around with that for our breakfast.
Do they do like the grunt work? Are they chopping onions and peeling potatoes and that kind of stuff?
Putting the delivery. I did that for my first 2 years working in the kitchen. I used to peel onions, but now I don't cry. So, you know, you learn the tricks of the trade, you know. They cut their fingers every day. They cut their fingers every day. But after you cut your finger a certain amount of times, you learn how not to
cut your fingers.
To cut yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. So it's almost like you can almost liken it to the military. Like, you kind of have to be broken in the beginning.
Yes.
For the first couple of years. And then if you can get through that grind, you're designed for the kitchen. If that is too hard for you, you won't handle.
You'll know.
You'll leave. It's you'll not leave. For you. You won't be.
Yeah. It's not for you, you know, because it's not for everybody. That's why I say it's pirates. We're pirates, yeah.
I like that analogy. Okay. So now we've got them. Okay. Who's next in the kitchen?
Next, I have your chef de partie. So they'd be the chef de partie would be in charge of their division. So the kitchen's broken up. You got like the saute station, the grill station, and like pantry. So people who make the salads, people who do the saute would be your fish or your pastas, anything that's in the pan. Then your grill is your guys who are doing your steaks, your chicken. Yeah, They're the ones who cook it to order. So, but everybody has a role. I mean, if I get an order with one pasta, one steak, one fish, we all need to work
together
in a team. But we're opposite each other there.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So those chef de partie are in control of their sections. So they make sure that just that department, my pantry department, is stocked. I'm ready for service. This is what I need. I've given chef the orders that I need. I need this. I need this. It's done. So they're accountable for that. So when I come around on the line, I'm not going to the commis chef because the commis chef is taking orders from
the chef de partie. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
I go to that person. As long as that's done. And then after that level, then you get my sous chef.
Yes.
So my sous chef would be my second. Okay. So he's my bark. He's probably more online hardworking than I would be.
Yeah.
Because he's the one who's cracking the whip. I just need to go and look. He's the one shouting at them on the daily. No, chef doesn't want it like this. We need to do it like this. I mean, he's the hungry one who wants to be at my level. I'm more now. It's kind of sad. You kind of have to resign yourself to management now. A lot of more paperwork, meetings, dealing with suppliers, creatives. Yes. But he's the man in the kitchen. He's the bite. You know. He's the.
Okay. And so now you mentioned before that prior to this you worked under a Michelin star chef. Was that in Ireland or was that in America?
That was in Ireland. As soon as COVID ended, he was the first chef I worked for,
Okay, and could you say that there was any notable difference between like a Michelin star kitchen that you worked in as opposed to any other? Or is it like kind of just, it's the same, just a level up?
Yeah, like I said, I think no matter where you work, from South Africa to India to wherever, there's a certain language within the kitchen that we all understand.
Yeah.
You know, so there's always that base level. But then it comes down to the leadership, you know, like being able to buy into the vision of the chef. And, you know, that Michelin star chef, if he wants things in a certain way and he thinks in a certain way, you by design have to think that way. If you can't think that way, you're you're not valuable to the team. And yeah. So I want to say, yes, there were some similarities, especially to when I was in America, because I worked for that CMC. But I think the attention to detail and just the obsession for greatness was the difference. Yes.
Okay.
If you know what I mean. Yeah.
No, that's awesome. The obsession.
Mm. Yeah. And I actually want to know, like, the restaurant world is always such a fast-paced environment. There's always new things, new trends, new foods, new styles that you're having to keep up with and either make it work or change rapidly. And I want to know, like, from a training perspective or a training point of view, one, for yourself, do you get, I guess, coached or led into a certain way of picking out new menu items? So if you're having to do a refresher of menu, say it's a seasonal thing, so from a winter menu to a spring menu each year, I'm assuming that you're having to do something different. Maybe it isn't necessarily changing the entire menu, but changing bits and pieces. Yeah, so is that
sticking to trends and yourself? That kind of stuff.
Exactly. You stick to trends, do you are you steadfast in a certain palette? And then additionally for your staff, like, a thing that we see a lot on MasterChefs, on My Kitchen Rules, all of these shows, are how one would move from a cook to a chef. So being knife skills, having an understanding of the different styles of food. So French is completely different to, say, how Italians cook. Is this something that is provided to staff at not necessarily just the REN or all of your previous experience? Or is it something that you essentially have to vouch for yourself and say, hi guys, management, I see that this is an up and coming trend. Let's say sushi as an example. Sushi has now hit the market. Everyone's big on sushi and doing flame doused sushi, like fiery at Monty as an example. Now, is it something that you present to management, or is it something that is general conversation?
So, you know, you learn quick, kind of, especially when you come and I came to Ireland, you learn quick that you're not at home. You know, there's a certain way people do things here, and you kind of also have to adapt to that. And, like, you know, yes, we're a restaurant, but I'm also a hotel. And so a lot of what I'm able to execute within what we do has to be focused on that. You know, we're still a hotel. We still have international guests that... Not everybody who stays at a hotel is the sustainable, conscious, foodie type person. Some of them are just corporate people that come in. They just want their steak. They just want their fish and chips. They just want this. So we still need to be able to cater for your general hotel guest, your hotel family thing. So sometimes you learn with your clientele or the market what you can do, what you can't do. And, you know, and then you get times, because you're a hotel, you get times where you get a little bit of a flair to show off. We have many functions, people who come in, weddings, or Irish Women's Magazine for Women's Day, they want to come in and have this elaborate events, and then we get to create great menus with the organizers, and they're thinking summer, they're thinking this, and we can tie it into their ideas, you know. So yes, we have to keep it fresh, because as we say, seasons change, things change, the weather changes, you know, new produce comes in, and we would like to keep things local. So some seasons, asparagus isn't as fresh or isn't as cheap. You have to try and look for something else. So you look at what's available and how you can do it, you know? And that, I think that comes with just experience, you know, and especially with me living in different places and just understanding that everywhere you go, there's a different base or base level of what you should offer and then what you can offer, you know? So there's that. And in terms of the staff and the training, I always say to my staff that I think there's a personal accountability into this too. Like, this is what I'm creating. This is my vision. You want to learn more and you want to do more. I think that you, as a chef, as an ambitious chef, should take the steps that you need to do to learn more. Come and ask me more questions.
Yeah.
Research a certain more things. Ask me if you can go for this course and then I can give it to you. But I am not there handing it to you, because it's the military. Like I said, I'm not there to feed your dream and your ambition. I'm there to provide a platform for you to achieve it, but you need to feed it, if that makes sense.
Otherwise
you're wasting everybody's time. I wouldn't be here today if my chefs just gave me everything that I wanted. I needed to prove to them and show them that this is what I want, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that. I think that's really cool. And I also just want to say a little ode to you, what I heard you say there about the kitchen porter being the most important person in your kitchen. I think it's a very big indication of your character that is like your level of understanding. It just shows like your humility and your I don't think anybody was expecting that to be the answer, you know. It could have very easily turned into a joke, and you could have been like, yeah, the most important person is me, which would have been funny in itself. But the fact that you paid homage to like the kitchen porter and like the basic functionalities of that, I must say it's really, really commendable. And I think it shows kind of your awareness of like where you are and the way things are going and what's important as well, you know, like the things that matter. But now I have another question for you. So there's an episode of Friends that I remember watching. And in this particular episode, Rachel is flirting with a doctor. And this particular doctor is a gynecologist. And they're busy talking. And he says to her, oh, I broke up with my previous girlfriend. Like it didn't work out. So Rachel asks him, oh, why? And he's like, well, you know, let me put it to you this way. You're a waitress, right? And I'm a gynecologist. Is there any time when after a full day of serving coffee, when you get home, that you just feel like, oh, if I see one more cup of coffee? So my question to you is, when you get home, right? You've had a long day slogging it in the kitchen. It's been a late shift. You spoke earlier about the hours. When you get home, are you making yourself an egg on toast? What kind of pleasure, or how has it influenced your pleasure of cooking for yourself and like for you and your partner? Like, how does that look? Or is it just something that is always with you?
I'm going to talk for all chefs here, not just myself. I promise you, most chefs, especially when you get to the head level, we don't really cook well for ourselves.
Okay.
Just to be very honest, you'll find a great Michelin star chef. I'm sure even Gordon Ramsay has frozen pizzas in the freezer. It's a lot. It is hard because you're at work all day. You're tasting, you're smelling, you're dealing with food, you're doing this, and you're just behind it. And then to come back home and then be elaborate with it too. And then not just that, but you know, when you're at work, you have all the resources. Like,
yes.
Everything I can possibly imagine, any scenario that comes up, I have it, you know?
Yeah,
when you're at home, you don't necessarily have every tool, every ingredient, you know, every resource that you have available to you. But I will say it has influenced me when I'm trying with my friends, or, you know, we're having like a little dinner nights when friends come over and we cook them dinner, or, you know, your girl comes over and you're trying to impress somebody. That's when I can, you know, I can chef it up and I can show off just that little bit more. I'll take that extra step and I'll cook something really nice for us then in that moment. But in general, man, you know, I generally be at work and I'll cook something at work. And before I leave, I can say to my sous chef or someone, yo, just cook me that. I'm going to take it home in a box. I mean, it's still great quality, but I'm not trying to come home and, you know, be behind the stove and wash the dishes
make some
again.
I can't, no.
You know, but we do have our moments. It really depends how you feel, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, man. Yeah, like for all of those who are either aspiring home chefs, just love to cook, what are like some of your top tips? So if we look at things like life hacks, what are some of the hacks? So you spoke initially about onions. People always cut onions, and you have a trick or a method that
I need to cut
the onion so I don't tear up. What are like just some general tricks?
General tips. Okay, this one kind of caught me off guard, but I'll try answer this. Normally with onions, what I know for a fact is that most times people are using a blunt knife. So if you think about this onion is full of like this acidic liquid. So if you're using a blunt knife, it's squirting, you know?
Yes.
As chefs, your secret is your knife is razor sharp. So when you're cutting through that thing, there's less.
I said this.
There's less traction for it to burst and into your eyes. You know, sometimes you get people who have a spoon in their mouth, or they put the onion in water and they're doing this. I think the easiest thing is to be quick with it. Like a chef, if you're quick, you're not taking 30 minutes to cut an onion. It's fast, it's clean, easy cuts.
Yeah.
Slicing onion, you know? That's one trick. You know, I think also another thing that people always overlook is that, like, you know, cooking is probably one of the oldest things people have ever done, professions, if you think about it. Like, there's nothing new I can I can tell people, you know, sometimes food is just food and never overcomplicated, but cook from the heart, you know, like cook the simple stuff that reminds you of, that take you back to memories, you know, like there's a reason why I can eat back home we used to eat like pap and vos with beans, and it sounds so weird, but I can't get that over here. But every time I do make it for myself, I would immediately think of my Auntie Susan. It takes me back. Oh,
yeah,
Auntie Susie, you know, it's something like that. Or a braai broekie. I ate a braai broekie the other day, and it took me back to with going on holiday with you and your family. Vunalekkers at the caravan. And I was like, you know, it's not something that was in my culture, but it takes you back there. And sometimes I think, even as chef, people try to overcomplicate food. At the end of the day, food is food. It just needs to taste good. And that's the first thing. And then you can try to shoot up.
Elaborate.
You can elaborate. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like for me, that. One of my, I guess, problems in the kitchen is timings. So timings is always a tough thing. Either I'm cooking something in the oven, there's something on the stovetop, there's a sauce on the side, and trying to get all of that cohesive, like, and to work perfectly where everything is still hot at the same time. And I think in addition to that, like cooking a steak, how many minutes is the rule of thumb to having a medium steak between having a medium rare? Are there like rule of thumb? Do you just know? Is it something that comes with experience?
I kind of just know now, but how you can learn is if you take your hand, right? So if you take your hand and you take this index finger with your thumb, this would be, the first one is medium rare. So if you feel the steak, it's medium rare. Okay. And then if you put it to the next finger, it gets a little bit harder. Your steak will be medium well. Or medium. Okay. Medium. Then medium well. And then the last one will be well done.
Okay.
So if you're pressing down, just so that you kind of have like a little bit of a reference to what it should feel like. Because, you know, I've gotten to the stage where I look at the steak and I can just press it to know it's at its optimum. Hmm. Optimum temperature, you know. So that's sure. One.
Didn't know that.
I think
that's a handy
trick. Tev is just showing us that you don't have to worry. He can't mutiny you. He's showing us he lacks control and finesse. That's all he's doing.
Seemingly, he won't walk the plank just yet. You're safe. You're safe for now.
Is there so you said you've been all around the world. You've experienced different kitchens. You've cooked multiple different foods. Do you have like a particularly like a favorite cuisine that you like to cook? And I have a follow-up question to that as well. And Tev, you can also answer this. Someone asked me this the other day, and Nato, you're a perfect person to ask this question to. If you had to choose, so you're first going to answer your favorite cuisine to cook. Then the second question, and Tev, think about your answer. If you had to choose three cuisines to eat for the rest of your life, only three cuisines, what are those three cuisines that you would choose?
Okay, Tev, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll get myself out the way. I'll say Asian.
That's not a cuisine. That's not a cuisine.
It's too broad. It's like saying African.
Okay, so let me say...
You have to say Thai or Japanese or Korean or something. More specific. Yeah.
I was going to say Thai, but a lot of people say that Thai food isn't as distinct as Chinese food or Japanese food. There might be a few lies to that. So... But fine, I'll say Thai food first. Secondly, I'll say Italian. And then third, how would I define? South African has a few different elements in that make it unique. So I'm going to say South African. So those are my three.
That's a cuisine in itself. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go. You know, I'm gonna echo your last one there with the South African one, because you can't look. South Africa is like the melting pot. You got curry, you got Indian there, you got curry, you got a little bit of everything, you know. That's a good one,
and you can't find it everywhere. That's the realization that I came to since moving out of SA. It's like these simple pleasures which you think I can just go to the supermarket, get the ingredients, make it, not a chance.
Can't get vors here. I haven't had vors in almost it's a problem. No one knows that is standing after a nightclub having a booty roll, you know. I mean, come on. You can't beat that. I would like to say Thai too. You know, I've never been to Thailand, but all the other countries that I've been to, there's always been a great version of Thai food, you know.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I just love the flavors of it and the freshness. No matter where you go, it just feels fresh and it feels wholesome, you know, it feels healthy. That's yeah. really good. American food, we can leave
can
that
forget.
we can leave that behind. And then thirdly, you know, I've really started to enjoy your Middle Eastern cuisine, which is kind of weird, but I've started getting into that, like, you know, kebabs is things that throw into the stove, like your goat meat, you know, stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to pinpoint because it's my job to
a little bit of everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to isolate, you know, it's because it changes. I think I change every year and what I like changes every year. Yeah. So you're asking me this.
Well, then, then instead of asking you like your favorite cuisine to cook, what have you found the most challenging? What's been the most difficult? It could be a dish or a cuisine, something that you like. Because I know, like, the Japanese, for example, like, kind of pride themselves on, like, this. There's, like, this fanciness to it. Like, you know, like, with the puffer fish, like, if you have to cut it in a certain way, you actually apparently need a license to cook puffer fish, because if you prepare it wrong, you can kill your patron when you eat it. Yeah. And then there's also like chicken sushi, like you get that in Japan, and I just think raw chicken, and I'm like, that's salmonella.
Salmonella.
Yeah, but they pride themselves on like the cleanliness of the chicken, and it's very much like a technique based a cuisine, from what I understand. So, what would you say has been like the most challenging like cuisine or dish or whatever?
For me, it's definitely going to be like your classic French techniques. You know, the guy I worked for was a certified master chef in America. He was like a military sergeant. He literally broke us down from day one when we landed off that plane. He killed any dreams and ideas that we had about us doing it our way, and he drilled us in his way. And his way was so perfect. Everything you did had to, in French cuisine the same, has to follow a procedure. There's no shortcuts. There's certain ways to cut a Paisan potato versus a Brunois. There's certain ways to cut a Dover sole fish or to do this, you know? So I want to say the French technique, because it's so old, and I think it's inherent in everything we do in terms of the a la carte menu, from a starter, main dessert, the fact that we eat three-course menus is French. The techniques that we use, the way we cut onions that we use globally is French. And I just think to master that origin of cooking, you know, that home of cooking, to get those techniques down to the T, I think is the most challenging thing for any chef. But if you do get those things down, I think you can be great anywhere you go, because those are the fundamentals of food. And as long as you have the fundamentals down, then you can explore and, you know, create. But for me, definitely, you know, French cuisine is not a joke. It's the core of food, in my opinion.
Quite like that.
Okay.
So Ty, your three cuisines there?
Yeah.
Oh, my three cuisines. Hard. Oh, yeah. So I said Thai. Obviously living here in Noto, I think you've perfectly summed it up. It is very, it's got a very fresh, very wholesome, very a very nice flavor. Like, it's really, really, I've really learned a lot about food since I've been here, both as myself, like, because I started cooking a lot more since I've been here, but also just eating out a lot more. So yeah, I said Thai, Italian, because I just like love the idea of Italian food. And then I actually, I didn't say South African, which was a good, it's actually a good shot. But at the time I was trying to I was thinking in the terms of like, this would be the rest of my life. So I wanted it to be balanced. So I actually said Argentinian, because I wanted a very meat-based, grill-based, and I've been to some excellent Argentinian restaurants.
Yes.
So I was like, I wanted some balance. And I know like they do a lot of like, proper, I want to say brying, but like that's like a very much a heart of their cuisine. So those were the three that I chose when I answered that question to my friends.
Those are great shouts. I won't lie. That's a great shout.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, bro. So Tyler and I have previously talked about dishes that we've tried in our respective countries that we've either loved or hated, and we've, I guess, done a poll with the locals who said, oh, this is amazing. You have to try fish and chips in the case of the UK. Oh, it's like the best meal ever.
We're
so renowned for it. Mushy peas, jellied eel, all of these strange things. And
I'm sure you had a proper pie, though.
So they say, but hey, take me to a BP or engine garage. Levels.
Mutton curry pie.
Pimons, man. Come on. So in your time in Ireland, what's some of the dishes that you've had there that are, I guess, unique to the region that you've either liked, loved, or hated?
Okay. How can I say this? You know, in Ireland, their cuisine is very tough because they went through what we call the famine. So yeah, yeah. There was a large time here where a lot of all they could get was potatoes and grow these potatoes and stuff. So their cuisine has kind of been influenced a lot by different aspects and different people coming in. But the typical Irish things, yeah, I've had this thing, it's called Cahill. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I'm not. I'm not butchering it. It's kind of like a white sausage stew, but it's like an organ sausage stew, okay. Which it was weird for me at first to kind of comprehend what it was. But, you know, with time and with a little trying, it's not the worst thing. It's pretty interesting. It's something that you could get into. And then secondly, I'd also say pudding. Mm. I don't think too many places eat pudding. It's kind of like a breakfast staple here. Okay. So it's made out of
black and white.
Yeah, this black and white. So the black one is made out of like congealed pork blood.
Yeah.
And they mix it with like, you know, oats, different aromatics and spices. Mm-hmm. And they harden it to make a sausage. So you'd have that generally with your breakfast items. And then the white one is made out of also organs, so your pancreas, but mix the same with oats and different seasonings to make that. So that has kind of hit me on the mouth when I first came here. I was like, wow, I thought I'd never, like, how are you going to eat blood? What are you guys doing eating this? But, you know, it's actually with time and everything and just open mind, you know, you get to learn why things are important and how good they are, you know. Yeah. So that kind of hit me in the mouth. Okay. In Utah, I'm sure you've had more exotic things in Thailand. I'm pretty sure about that.
Well, I actually wanted to say, while you were talking, I was just thinking to myself, this is actually one of the most beautiful things about food, and it's just a kind of a revelation that I came to now, and I'm obviously not the first person to have this, but it's so interesting how you can see the history of a country, or it tells us so much about a country when you look at the food that they eat. Like you said, like the due to the famine, how that has influenced the cuisine and the culture so much. And, you know, everywhere you go around the world, there's a story to be told. You know, South Africa as a diverse country with a diverse group of people, look at how diverse our cuisine is. You know, like you said, it's a melting pot. Japan, which is very secluded and was never really colonized, is very, very Japanese and very exclusive, and it reflects in their cuisine. You know, I think it's exceptionally interesting. For me, in terms of like the exotic foods and stuff, when I first came around past Thailand, I ate a scorpion, like a fried scorpion. But that's more of a tourist thing, to be honest with you.
Taste-wise, but, did you taste much, or was it just like the taste of
It kind of tasted like everyone says, when you don't know how something tastes, you say it tastes like chicken. It kind of tasted like chicken. Like, but
was it cooked?
It's deep fried. It's deep fried. So, but I
to be like Mapani worms that are deep fried. It just tastes like cooked.
But I couldn't get my head past the fact that I was chewing on a scorpion, you know. But yeah. I will say that they have grubs here that they serve as like a drinking snack. So like it's like crickets and like little worms and stuff that are deep fried, and when you're drinking, like traditionally what Thai people do is they'll have these like crispy, it's just like crispy and salty, really. That's all it tastes like. So
Sorry to interrupt. Do you remember watching The Lion King when Timon and Pumbaa are looking up into the sky and they have this platter of grubs? And they're like, show Timon.
That's exactly what
you said. You just kind of made me think about that. So
Perfect analogy. But same thing here as you, Nato, is I'm also like, you don't really imagine yourself eating blood. It's not that big, but there's some soups here that you eat, like noodle soups that the most famous one has been, they've had this soup for like 50 years that they've just been topping up and recooking and adding more of the ingredients into, and the base of that soup is often blood. And it's the same thing, like it makes it very rich and very dense in flavor, and it's the same as you. I never really pictured, You know, it's not really a thing that you think is going to be. To be honest with you, Katia loves that soup, but she can't move past the mental thing.
Aspect of it. And sometimes that happens. There's a block for all of us. But, you know, we have to live and learn. No, everybody is from somewhere else. And that's the beauty, I think, of travel and food is because, as you said, it tells a story. And we all live a different way and a different life. I mean, South Africa, we've got people who eat crickets.
Yeah,
you know, crickets. Sure. In Brazil, they eat ants. It's just part of what it is, you know.
Yeah, here as well, one of the delicacies is ant eggs. They're bitter though. They're very expensive and they were quite bitter. I didn't enjoy those. And the other thing that I tried, which is also quite unique, is they call them jumping shrimp. So it's like these baby shrimp that you basically, the guy that you buy it from normally is on a motorbike, and next to it he has like a fish tank attached to his motorbike, and there's just live shrimp swimming around. And basically what he does is he just scoops out a bag with all the shrimp in it, and you pour that out into a bowl like a soup, and you add this like green chili sauce into it, which I think the acidity kind of kills them, but not always. And then you like drink them like that, and then like, I don't know if it was just in my head, but I swear they were jumping in my stomach. That's a feeling that I had.
Thailand just seems so unique. I'd love to see it, man. Yeah, I need to get out there sometime.
Yeah, you must. You must really. I think you'll enjoy the culinary cuisine, and to see how, what's super interesting for me is like when you go, like I said, people have like a motorbike and attached to it, they'll have like a cart, and on that cart is everything that they need to create 10 dishes that they live off and sell. So normally it will be like a rice-based person, and all the ingredients are on this motorbike. And for the night, they park their motorbike there, and the wok, they have their gas, and they cook for you then and there. And I've never had like better fried rice than I've had from a person next to a Honda Wave. You know, it's incredible to see that.
No, I'd love to.
Yeah, no, for real. But before we start rounding off back to our wholesome moments, we wanted, if anyone's watching and you have a look at Nato's jersey, you'll have a look-see that we have an opportunity, a unique opportunity here to gang up on Tevin a little bit. And I want to ask you, let's do a quick like little summary. We try not to make it go too long, but also it is our show and our episode, so if it goes a bit long, who cares. You and I have been Arsenal fans for as long as I can remember, both of us. For years and years, we've seen the rise and fall of the mighty Arsenal. And we can all agree this is a unique Arsenal season. And what for me, my favorite thing is that it's not a once-off season. I can guarantee that. Next season, it's not like we're going to filter away like anyone else. But you tell me, Nato, how have you felt? We haven't spoken at all this season. How have you felt about the season? What has been your highs and lows? Do you like this thing of calling us bottle jobs? Where are you at? What's your feelings?
You know, it was a hard season for me to watch. I won't even lie. It was hard to sit and watch and enjoy.
It's emotional. Yeah.
All the games. Yeah, it's actually, it takes a lot out of me to sit there and watch an Arsenal game. But I want to say everyone says enjoy the ride. And you know, the longer we were top of the table, the more I think anxious I got with each game. Like, so I couldn't even enjoy it at that stage. Like, just enjoy it while we're top. And it was really difficult to do that. And you know, now that we've kind of dropped back to what I would say would be second, and we probably won't win the league this year.
Yeah.
But I can look back at the year and the year before with a little bit of hindsight and perspective. And I can just say, you know what, I'm proud of the season that the boys had, because we started with no expectation to pushing one of the best teams in world football.
To the end, we pushed them
to the end, you know, and not just that, but still playing a unique brand of football along the way and giving opportunity to homegrown Arsenal players, which bodes well for us, because like I said, this is not a one-off thing, because you can look at the likes of, you know, your Martinelli, Smith Rowe, your Saka's, Edin Nketiah's. These are Arsenal boys, and they're re-signing contracts, they're invested, and it just shows that we've got a base to move on to. So it's exciting looking forward, but you know, the way I look at it is like, I don't know next year if we'd be in a position again at Christmas being 8 to 11 points ahead. So it's just kind of getting through that mental hurdle, that next step. So, you know, it's still going to be tough watches, but I support the boys all the way. So I don't know how you feel about it.
We have to believe that. I don't think this... Everyone's saying that because the other teams were so weak, this was such a unique opportunity for Arsenal. But I kind of disagree with that. I really strongly disagree with that. I think there has been Although your top four has not, your traditional top four hasn't been as strong, I think all the opposition has been a lot stronger than most other seasons. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever been so. If you look at between, like, let's say 20th to 11th or even up to like 9th, it's so close as well, which just shows you the quality of what the Premier League is about. And to say, oh, Arsenal only did it because Chelsea wasn't there or Liverpool, I strongly disagree with that. I don't think it's fair to say that, you know. But I agree, it's been stressful. Difficult to enjoy the moment. And since we kind of, those three games that everyone will all talk about, the Liverpool, West Ham, Southampton, those three games. Those three games really cost us. But since after City, and City outclassed us, I'll say that hand on heart, they were much better than we were. And Tevin was at the game. Bastard.
I feel bad for Lisa at that time.
yeah. But since that moment, even when I watched the Chelsea game, who do we play? Oh, first we played Leeds, I think, after City. And it really, I won't say, it obviously wasn't nice to have dropped the ball, but it was nice to watch. And you could see the players were playing with less stress.
Yeah.
And it was more enjoyable for me in that, I'll be honest with you, that moment, and then watching us beat Chelsea and the performance against Newcastle, it was enjoyable again. But I do think next season we'll play, like, we'll be there again, maybe not as clear ahead, but I think you draw on the experiences that you go through, much like you as a chef, me as a teacher, Tev in the marketing world, you draw on those experiences. And these guys, these elite athletes, that's what they'll do. They'll draw
on. And we've seen the growth. We've seen the growth under Tits and how much they've grown. Yeah.
And do you have your top player of the season? One or two?
You know, well, me, I love Martin Odegaard. My captain. You know, I love him and I think he's the obvious choice. But I have a soft spot for Saka because, you know, he's our star boy. And, you know, he's been with us through Unai Emery and Lundberg and into this moment, and he for a lot of times before he had other people around us, he carried us. And so for him to still be like the first player into double digits with goals and assists for the season at the young age that he is, you know, I just think that he's definitely one for the future, and he's somebody that I can look proud on and say, like, you know, that's our Haaland boy. Exactly. So, but Martin Odegaard, I have to give it out, you know, my captain. He's been the catalyst, him and Partey, for everything that's been good this season. I think they've been behind it all. So, yeah.
And captain on the field, for you. I really feel.
Dan?
What's that?
Shot for you, player of the season?
Yeah. I think I love Bukayo Saka. Martinelli as well. He's been a pleasure to watch. But, you know, obviously watching Big Bill Saliba, the Rolls Royce of defenders. He's so clean. Ben White has had an incredible season. I've thoroughly enjoyed him. Hey, Benny Blanco. Mr. Steal Your Girl. Lock up your girl. Hey, Mr. man. Mr. Love Island. He's too suave. But the whole team, there's just so much to like about it, man. Like, from Ramsdale right through the 11, there's just so much to like and so much clever business that's been going on. And then, like, I really, really, I actually wrote this whole long blog about, like, why it's such a pleasure to be an Arsenal fan. And, you know, this is no, like, not a dig at you, Tev, but I mean, like, honestly, when I look at Arsenal from all angles and all perspectives, and I think it's similar with being a Liverpool fan, actually, there's actually nothing to be ashamed of. There's only pride in supporting my team. We don't have to hide behind our 153 counts of whatever that's there. And this is just me. This is just my feeling. And it's been such an awesome season because I just love how easy it is to be proud. And you see the work that they're doing with these Syrian refugees. They've got a huge, big project. There's just so much. I look at my team and I'm like, there's no angle you can attack me from that I feel ashamed of anything. There's nothing.
To add on that, and not to attack you more, Taylor, but just even the continuity within, you know, Arsenal football, we've always been a classy club. We've always tried to do things the right way. We always try to do things the right way. Always try to play football the right way. We went years where we had Danielson, Shamak, Bentners, Scolacci in our team.
Juru.
But we still played beautiful football. You know, we still try to keep that. And, you know, with even just how giving a manager like Mikel Arteta, a young manager, unproven, the opportunity to and the time to imprint his philosophy into the team, which was greatly influenced by Arsene Wenger and the culture of what Arsenal is. It just bodes to the success, I think, we're witnessing now, because there's this continuity of style, vision, and, you know, culture. You know, I think that's the most important thing that I think within, and, you know, so
yeah.
I'm just proud of my team because of that. I can go down proud to all my friends and say, yeah, even back in those days, I was still talking nonsense about my team, but at least now I can say.
And it's a question I asked Tyler, and I actually want to ask you the same question. So Tyler alluded to, like, bottle jobs. Is this season a failure? All of that aside, we obviously, in football, they say silverware is what counts at the end. But given the progress that Arsenal have made, both as a team, both, I think what really bodes well for Arsenal, not just this season, but next season and seasons to come, is the mental aspect of it. I think a lot of the time people are so focused on
Princess of the moment
that they aren't very conscious of the process. And to come back in games where you pretty much dead and buried, to come back and at the very least get a draw, if not go on to win the game, it's incredible for such a young squad. So I wanted to find out from you, if you finish the season second, right? Which is it a failure for you for the season? Mm. Or is it still seen as, because previously, before the season started, all talk was just getting back into Champions League. Winning the league wasn't a consideration. So I want to find out, is that the same position that you're in? The mindset that, look, objective is achieved. Yeah, I wanted to get into Champions League. I'm there now. The winning the title was just the icing on the cake. Or is it seen as, wow, we were ahead for so long in the season. To lose it now does feel like a bit of a letdown.
Can I take it quick, Ty?
Yeah, you do it. It's you.
You know, for me, it's funny how narratives are so subjective in that sense, you know, because at the beginning of the season, that this conversation wasn't even a good question.
Yeah.
Would this be a failure? I mean, so for us as Arsenal fans, who have been supporting this team forever, as true Arsenal fans, this is a successful season because we came into the season not even hoping to get top four, getting back into the Champions League and then pushing on from there, you know.
Yeah.
But it's funny how it just shows how far we've come if now the narrative has switched to now, is it a failure for Arsenal to have finished second? For me, it's actually a crazy thing to compare it to, because you're looking at a team that Manchester City. It's like looking at Liverpool. Over the past 5 years, Liverpool won the league once.
Yeah.
During a COVID year. Does that then make Klopp's time there a failure? No. Like, you know, you're going against this juggernaut of a team, and you're getting plus 90 points every season. It has to be looked at, as Arsenal fans, as a positive, as a building block to where we're going next year. We've seen the emergence of young players. We've seen the emergence of Saliba, Saka, Martinelli, you know, the importance of Gabriel, the identity, the Ben White playing at right back. It's been a revelation. Who would have seen that coming? You know, so there's a lot of things within the club to be positive and happy about. And to finishing second to Manchester City and still getting, which I presume would be just shy of 90 or 90 points, is an excellent season. I think it'll be Arsenal's highest points tally in history.
Yeah, it will equal Invincibles if we get 90,
No, that's right. Yeah, answer, you know. Like I was saying to Ty, if you take Manchester United season into context, so if they went on to win the FA Cup, they'd say it's a brilliant season. Even if they finish outside of Champions League and they're playing Europa again, but because they've won two titles. But I think a lot of cup competitions are luck-based, more often than not.
It's who you need get a bit of fortune, you play,
a bit of luck, who you drawn against.
It's important for them, though, too, because it's Ten Hag's first season. Like, Arsenal kept
Arteta,
and we built on because we won the FA Cup. And for us, it was an important season, and that's the basis that Arteta did to build us to where we are today. So for United fans, I can understand why they would say that this is a successful season for themselves.
I think United bottling the top four is, I think, worse than Arsenal bottling. Bottling top four in this scenario is worse than Arsenal bottling the league to City, because and I hate the word bottle, but losing the league to City, because if you look at the who City is and Haaland coming in and everything he's done, but to bottle top four now, I think will be really bad for United. Like, honestly, if you ask me. But Tev, you need to, do you have any defense that you need to say in Man City's favor, other than we know how good they are, but all these things that we're saying,
I'll bring it how back does it feel to, as a fan? To fighting the established hierarchy. It's always this exclusive boys club, especially in Premier League football. It's Arsenal, it's Chelsea, it's Liverpool, it's United. And I think there's been such a big emphasis on having that establishment remain that establishment, which is why, and I think you and I spoke about this in, I'm not sure which episode it was, but when you talk about investment and a lot more, I guess, trying to balance the scale. So obviously for City, it's been a really exponential growth in a very short space of time. When you're looking at the established top four, it was years of big budgets, big names, lots of backing. A lot of these things played in their favor to establish themselves and keep them established as top fours, hierarchies. You're playing in Champions League, all of these things, sponsorship deals, whatnot. But there was a lot of investment consistently for a long time. Whereas now we're seeing a lot more, I think, investment, both flexibility in terms of the kind of owners you get, far and wide. So it's not necessarily just English, it's American, it's Saudi, it's whatever it is. And I think, look, maybe that's my defense as a City fan, is that yes, there are allegations here, and it must be
court, allegations must
be guilty, innocent until proven guilty. But I think this is the time and the period, our lifetime is the time when you'll see the established four being challenged greatly, where the top four becomes a top six, top eight, of where, from a power point of view, it somehow moves towards a bit of a balance. So you aren't always given the luxury. Like, City spending isn't going to continue on forever. We're seeing more and more investment into clubs. So I'll take Newcastle as this season. Let's say we run that on for five seasons. In the next 10 years, we have, what did I say, Brighton. Brighton become a super club or a big club that get gang investment. Now we're suddenly sitting with guys like, who's a very young player. Let's say
Musiala.
Wanyeri.
There we go. He's going for 250 million bought by Brighton, because now Brighton have these massive investors from the US or whatever it is. But I think this hierarchy and this, I guess, exclusive club that all the established, the big top four clubs historically have had, this is the time in our lifetime that you'll see this big balance out.
I think
and all of this started as glory hunting, obviously. If you look at why you became Arsenal fans, or your parents became Arsenal fans, or Liverpool, United, Real Madrid, Barcelona, everyone that supports a top team, was because you win things. Obviously, for Arsenal, it's also the fact that you play great football. But if Henry wasn't there, if Bergkamp wasn't there, if you weren't winning things, if you weren't the Invincibles, let's say...
Henry was my guy. Henry was my influencer.
Who's someone that hasn't won in like forever?
Everton. Spurs. I love that.
But you get what I'm saying.
Everton, like, or everyone, one of those kinds of clubs, yeah.
So in like 50 years' time, when, let's say, you know, City is now playing in either the Premier League, or what if you've dropped down into League One? It's because there will be a new established team that is winning consistently, and we'll have more and more of the youth then buying into these clubs. And that's just the period that we're in. Like,
but history still remains. Newcastle will always be a big club. Nottingham Forest, even now that they've come up, there's still an idea that they're still a big club. Leeds United, everybody understands what they mean for the Premier League. So I still also do believe that there is a historic understanding about the teams that created the Premier League for what it is. There's those fan bases. But Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think you guys are getting there. You're changing the idea. You're getting a lot more English players in. Jack Grealish, the type of players that you're getting in, are trying to change the mindset of what Manchester City is and represents, you know?
Everyone has their time under the sun. And City isn't going to be the dominant force for years to come. It's not going to happen. We saw that with Liverpool. We saw that with Arsenal. We saw that with United. There's going to be a massive fall off. And we're going to have a new established order or whatever you want to call it in football.
Every squad goes through like these. Squads go through these phases. And it's like, look at Liverpool. They didn't plan the rebuild. And that's what cost them this season, is that they weren't ready for the rebuild. But just before we wrap up, I do want to say, though, I heard an interesting fact yesterday that in terms of money, people say, oh, yeah, okay. Just to give you a perspective on the difference of City spending and not just buying players. The difference in the wage bill between Arsenal and City is the equivalent of having 12 players on £200,000 a week. That's the difference in our wage bills between Arsenal and City. So for people that think, oh, no, they're not spending that much, people forget, you know, like that. That is exceptional. But and it's not to say that you have... Though. Well, it's not to say that you have 12 players that are on 200K or more, but that is the difference when you're talking. And now Arsenal has to find, and if I would trust anyone, it's going to be Arteta to come up with innovative ways to overcome that, because we're going to have to, because we can't sign 12 players and give them 200K a week. We just can't. Our wage structure doesn't allow for it. So, yeah, no, it is going to be an interesting time, I think. But I think this might be a good, neat little spot to round off the episode. Yeah. Nato, it was really, really special having you, man. Honestly, one of the greatest times I've had recording with a guest. So thank you so much for joining us. We are definitely going to bring you on again. We really appreciate you taking out the time, man. Like, really, really, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I know our listeners will enjoy it too. So big ups and thank you. And keep fighting the good fight, man. I can't tell you how proud I am to have you as one of my, you know, like with gents, you don't always talk as much, but when you do, it's like it was just yesterday. That's how it felt today when we were talking. And I feel so proud to have you as a friend, you know, to look at like everything that you've done, everything that you've achieved. It's like, you know, like when you have that one friend that you tell everyone about, like, yo, my friend's a head chef, and not just that, he's like the sustainable forward thinking and really, really honest, so proud and so honored. So thank you so much for joining us. Really, really was a special one, man.
Thank you for having me, guys. I really want to just say it out there. Like, I've always been a fan about what you guys do here, and just even the fact that you guys do this and are able to bring me on here to share my words, it really means a lot to me. You know, we have our history together, and it just felt good to be here and to share a little bit of the knowledge and just have a good time. Just felt like I was talking with the gents, and you know, the people who know will know. So, you know, big ups to those people, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, and Tev, thank you. Thank you too, man. Thank you for organizing the whole day and even taking the time out. Tev's taken the time out since he's been in the UK. He's come around to visit, I think, on two or three occasions. I think he's been here more than I've actually seen him, if that even makes sense. He sends me random texts saying, I'm in your hotel, I'm off. I'm like, I don't know. You know, so even that, all the support, man, it means a lot to me, man. And hopefully, Tyler, if you have time in the future, you come out here and we'll welcome and host you here too, man. I look forward to that, guys.
Good, so, man.
Yeah,
man, just to echo those thoughts, we're really proud of you, man. You're really doing so much. You've achieved a lot in a very short space of time, and we just look forward to your continued growth and accolades that just keep coming and coming. Keep doing it, man. Keep flying that flag high. Everyone, you know where to find us. All our links are down below, and we'll see you at the next one. We have a very exciting idea with Nato, actually. We'll chat a bit more about that and let you guys be a part of that. But thank you again for being a part of this, and see you at the next one. Take care,
guys. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.